evictions are making this pandemic worse for everyone. A roadmap for keeping people housed. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, new efforts to get homeless into shelter here on the First Coast and across the country, and how to prevent more evictions. Give us a call now. Let us know how you're doing out there. It's 549-2937 to join us. Then later, we'll tell you how one local dad is cleaning up the St. John's River and even helping local police in the effort. We'll tell you about magnet fishing. But first this hour, the latest numbers on the pandemic. The State Health Department reports nearly 7,000 new cases overnight. The statewide total number of cases of COVID to date is nearly 1.8 million. Florida reported 197 more resident deaths yesterday. That includes 16 in Duval County, 21 in Clay County, the second deadliest day in Northeast Florida since the pandemic began. Statewide, the death toll from the coronavirus is 27,019. Meanwhile, the evictions triggered by the financial crisis tied to the pandemic have been linked to an increased risk of COVID cases and mortality. Cities, think tanks around the nation are working to help ease this crisis. In fact, just yesterday, the city of Jacksonville announced a new program to help people experiencing homelessness called the Pathway to Home Program. It's a rapid rehousing effort to get people off the streets in these cold temperatures. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is examining ways to help more people avoid losing their homes as the pandemic drags on. Dr. Girid Thirumalya is Senior Policy Officer with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. He's on the line now. Dr. Malia, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about efforts to get people who are homeless or at risk of being homeless under a warm roof? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa Injax, and our Facebook page is open. And you know, Dr. Malia, it's so timely that we're speaking with you this morning because right here in Jacksonville, a new program called Pathway to Home is giving people a local extended stay hotel room and food assistance for 30 days. And then there will be an effort to secure them permanent housing through a rapid rehousing initiative. There is a tent city in downtown Jacksonville of people who are living without shelter, and it's gotten bigger and bigger over these weeks. And now with cold temperatures across the area, not as cold as where you are, but cold for Jacksonville, it's become critical to get people into housing. So it's against this backdrop that I want to ask you about the research you want to share with our listeners today, showing that evictions and lack of eviction protections are linked to increased COVID cases and increased deaths. Tell us what you've learned at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Yes, thank you. Whether in a pandemic or not, we know that safe, affordable, and stable housing is essential to people's health and well-being. But that becomes only more the case when we're facing a threat like COVID. And there is now a growing body of research, as you should suggested, that if cities and communities are able to keep evictions at bay through policies, then they can lower their rates of COVID and even lower mortality. So that demonstrates really clearly that housing and health are very intimately connected. We've seen a great response from federal, state, and local governments, but we believe they can do more.
Right. It has been gratifying to see Jacksonville leaders take bold action on this. In fact, this is something that they've been urged to do for many years. Now, your research shows that in Jacksonville alone, landlords have filed for 5,016 evictions during the pandemic. That is despite a moratorium on evictions that has been extended month after month by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Talk a little bit more about that and the cascading effect of evictions on a family, how that affects families and kids.
Yeah. And the data that we're drawing from it's from the eviction lab. So yeah, thousands of evictions during the pandemic. What we see is that first is not having shelter. If people have to move from their home or apartment to the street, that brings with it a tremendous amount of both mental and physical stress on both adults and kids. But even for people that are unstably housed, so they may lose their home or apartment and they have to double up with a friend or family member, that can create a tremendous amount of emotional and mental stress. Plus, in the midst of a pandemic, there are good data showing that overcrowding in homes is one of the things that can trigger spread or transmission of COVID. It's being made very clear that indoor transmission of COVID, particularly in home settings, but also in restaurants and some workplaces, probably confers the greatest risk to people. Beyond that, when kids are have to move from their home, we know that it can disrupt their social networks. It can make it much harder for them to stay connected to school, even if school is virtual. And over the long term, it can have both developmental effects and effects on their physical health.
If you're just tuning in, as we speak with Dr. Malia from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, what do you think about Jacksonville's effort to get people out of a tent city that is located downtown and has gotten quite large in this pandemic? It's the Pathway to Home program, putting folks in a hotel room for 30 days along with food assistance, and then getting them rapidly rehoused. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Okay. And, you know, Dr. Malia, you also have some thoughts about the executive order from President Joe Biden on an eviction moratorium. You think it's good, but not strong enough. What else do you think the White House and local and state governments should be doing to ease this crisis?
Yeah, I think there are three things that I'd mention. First is that the federal eviction moratorium has been extended through the end of March. We believe it should be extended through the end of the pandemic and then an additional 90 days past that, because we know people are going to continue to struggle economically. The second is that loopholes in the moratorium need to be closed. For example, right now, to receive the protection of the moratorium, tenants need to submit a form to their landlord saying that they can't pay rent for a COVID-related and economic reasons. Most tenants don't even know about the form and that they have to submit it to their landlord. We think instead the eviction moratorium should be automatic. The last thing is that we need to make sure there's more rental assistance coming from Congress and that it actually gets to the tenants and landlords who need it. So landlords here also need relief because they need to make their mortgage payments. They need to maintain their building. We think that's particularly the case for small landlords. So making sure those rental assistance dollars get to the people who need them.
You know, it's funny. Whenever we touch on this topic, we sometimes we do get calls from landlords asking that we talk about their side of the equation. Often landlords will call in and say, I'm trying to work with my tenants. I understand how serious this situation is, but I'm struggling too. I have bills to pay too. At a certain point, tenants are going to be expected to pay back all of their missing rent. They're not in a position to do that. Landlords, on the other side of it, have to keep their buildings operating. They have to meet their financial obligations, and they know they're not probably going to get all those back rent payments. And it just keeps piling up and piling up. And what about the Biden White House moves forward on COVID relief? Critics of his proposal saying this is too much money to spend. This is too big of a proposal. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I think what we've seen through history is that when you have severe economic crises like this one, which is even more severe than during the Great Recession, that a very vigorous and robust federal economic response is needed, both for short-term economic stabilization, but also long-term recovery. And if we think about housing in particular, data has shown that people across the country may owe upwards of $70, $80 billion in back rent. So far, there's only
$80 billion?
Yes.
In America, $80 billion.
Yeah, it's a remarkable number. And so far, federal rental assistance has only provided about $25 to $30 billion. Now, there's another $25 to $30 billion in the Biden administration's proposal, which will help close the gap. And we also hope that the economy continues to recover and some of that debt gets paid down. But the need is enormous.
That is just a mind-blowing number, $80 billion. So the government's not going to make that whole. So then what is the path for tenants that aren't going to be able to pay their rent back, landlords that aren't going to get the assistance they need? We're looking at more evictions, more people who continue to struggle, right?
Well, I think there is strong support and growing support to make sure there is another big bolus of rental assistance funding in this next package to get us to close that gap, right? Because this is affecting, just as you said, both tenants and landlords. So I think that's going to get us part of the way there. Then we need to get this pandemic under control in every community in a consistent way, so that people can get back to work regularly and start contributing to these rent payments themselves. I think that's key. You know, we've also seen, you mentioned the program in Jacksonville, getting folks off the street into hotels and then into permanent housing. Exactly what cities need to do. And we just got good news over the past couple of days from the Biden administration saying that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is actually going to cover all 100% of the costs for cities that have been housing people in hotels. So I know that's something that local officials were really hoping would happen.
And let me ask you, Dr. Malia, how does the city of Jacksonville's effort to get people into hotels, get them off the streets, get them some food, and then get them into some kind of permanent housing, how common is this kind of initiative around the country right now? How does it compare to what you're seeing other cities do to try to address this problem right now? What are you seeing all across the land?
Yeah, I think we've been seeing similar efforts all across the country. And in some ways, it's remarkable because prior to the pandemic, all of us were living with the reality that many of our neighbors, people in our communities were living on the street. And it was just a reality that we were willing to accept. But the pandemic has turned that on its head, and policymakers and the public has said, we have to find a way to get folks housed so they're protected from the pandemic and from all the other dangers of living outdoors. So now the challenge for communities is, both morally and from a health perspective, people are saying you can't just put folks back out on the street, you know, particularly in colder places. This is not the time to do that. So now cities and states are trying to figure out how do we keep them housed, and permanent supportive housing is a key part of it. There is great research showing that permanent supportive housing, particularly for people with chronic physical health conditions or mental health conditions, not only improves their individual health, but actually saves costs for communities, saves costs from emergency room use, from need for drug and alcohol services, from criminal justice costs. So research really shows that this is the right thing to do for people and also for communities.
The Labor Department reports just this morning that another 779,000 Americans filed for first-time unemployment benefits in the last week of January, Dr. Malia. So unemployment continues to be high. People continue to need help. And, you know, I want to ask you a deeper question. Do you think the crisis of this pandemic has forced a rethink when it comes to homelessness? For so many years now, it's been tough to make the case that rapid rehousing will really go a long way towards solving this problem. People have been reluctant to support taxpayer spending on something like that. They think people should just get a job. Has the pandemic maybe opened people's eyes to the deeper issues and why this is perhaps a better way to approach this problem?
Mm-hmm. I think it has definitely opened people's eyes, but I'm not sure if it transformed what we will do in the long term. So far, I think we've seen folks want to respond in the midst of a crisis, but I think it's still an open question about what will happen over the long term. What we do know is that there's just a big mismatch between people's income and housing costs. Housing costs have continued to rise and rise and rise, but incomes for low and moderate wage workers have stagnated. Something needs to happen to bridge that gap. One of the long-term solutions that we are promoting is getting more housing into community ownership. There are models like community land trusts, for example, where the housing is owned by community and managed by community. What that generally does is that it keeps the prices of the housing affordable over time. And in times of crisis, community-owned housing is much more likely to work in cooperation and collaboration with tenants to keep them in their homes, maybe set up payment plans, find ways to meet in the middle. So that's the type of long-term change that we think is needed to ensure people housing affordability and stability.
Lots of comments on our Facebook page about this problem. Here's one from Siobhan. Real funding for real houses and the requisite care these folks need is the bare minimum. If we can't take care of our own, I don't want to hear about the Jaguars, the shipyards, the district, or any other project that will continue displacing people and contributing to the inequities in this town. Tina writes, I recently saw a Facebook post with before and after pics of people who were homeless that got makeovers from a dentist. One thing I noticed was that many of them hid their teeth in smiles before and after. People need basic dental care. It's interesting to get the feedback on social media as people follow this conversation, Dr. Malia. And, you know, I really would encourage everybody to drive through downtown Jacksonville. Just drive around and you will see that there are quite a few homeless people. There are always homeless people hanging around downtown, but there are a lot more right now than there have been. And, you know, it's interesting when you stop and talk to folks, as I do sometimes, Dr. Malia. Sometimes I'll talk to someone who's homeless, ask them about themselves, give them a little money if I have cash on me, which, by the way, people don't carry cash anymore as often. So that's another factor. And sometimes I'll say, you know, there are a number of shelters right down the street from here. Why don't you go to one of the shelters and get a bed, get a meal, get some help there. And it's just incredible how resistant a lot of these folks are to going to a shelter. Women who are homeless will say to me, I can't go to the shelter because I will be sexually assaulted. Men will say, men have a number of reasons that they've given me why they don't feel comfortable going into a homeless shelter. And so I was wondering if you have any thoughts about that. Some of the reasons why people are resistant to walking right into a shelter that's right there that they could take advantage of, because this dynamic is important to talk about too.
It is. And I think it's something that folks who haven't experienced homelessness or who haven't worked with folks who are homeless just can be hard to appreciate. But you're exactly right. I think many shelters can be unsafe or can feel unsafe to people who are homeless. And they have to make a calculation about whether they feel safer on the street or in shelters. And just as you said, sometimes they feel safer on the street. I think there are a couple things to think about. The first is that we found in programs here in Philadelphia, when formerly homeless folks work as outreach workers to educate people who are street homeless about shelter services that are available, what they can expect, how they can bring up concerns. Developing those relationships over time can really help to get people who have been chronically street homeless into shelters and into housing, but it takes relationships and it takes people knowing. I'll say the second thing, there's a model that some of your callers may be, and listeners may be familiar with. It's called Housing First. And what that says is that if people have significant medical conditions or even are struggling with addiction, the model typically is help folks get clean before they can get into housing. Housing First flips that on its head and says, give people housing first. Give them stability, shelter, and dignity, and then provide them wraparound services to help them with their physical and mental health issues. That model has been shown over and over again to be very effective at keeping people stably housed and getting them healthier. So that's a model that we think is essential for addressing homelessness in any city across the country.
Right. Housing First. That's the mantra when you talk to people from organizations here in Jacksonville, like Changing Homelessness or the Sulzbacher Center. The people that work on these issues have known this for a long time. Does it seem like finally policymakers are catching up, governments, you know, that whole machinery is finally catching up to this, it seems?
I think they are. I do think it's important for community members to recognize that, you know, when everyone is able, when each person is able to thrive in a community, the community as a whole benefits. And I think that's particularly the case with an issue like homelessness. We have solutions that work. I believe that we have the resources as the richest country in the world to meet these needs. And I do believe that people across the country want to do well by their neighbors. So we hope this is a moment that can make a real long-term change. We've done it in many cities for veterans who are homeless, and we can use some of the same strategies for other folks facing the same challenges.
Well, I want to thank you for your thoughts, Dr. Girather Mallya, Senior Policy Advisor with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, as we talk about homelessness and evictions. Thanks so much for being with us.
I really appreciate your time.
And by the way, you can look at changinghomelessness.org for more about this and also on our website, wjctnews.org. Much more coming up meanwhile. Later this hour, a look at the new way of cleaning up the St. John's River. One local dad takes us magnet fishing. Yes, magnet fishing. But up next.
Continuation of the double standards that we have observed in the American criminal justice system between white defendants and people of color.
Why some analysts say the Capitol siege defendants are getting kid glove treatment from the criminal justice system. We'll be right back. It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
World Affairs Council and UNF, partnering to engage citizens in becoming better informed participants in the global community. February 23rd, former diplomat Anya Manuel, This Brave New World, India, China, and the United States. Information, worldaffairscouncil.jax.org.
BritBox and PBS Passport are now offering the best of all your favorite British drama, comedy, and more when you sign up at jaxbundle.com. Start watching today.
Welcome back. Well, the Capitol siege defendants from the deadly violence and insurrection attempt on January 6th are now going through the criminal justice process, and that includes some local defendants. Some analysts have noted these mostly white Americans are receiving what they perceive to be kid glove treatment, at least so far. UNF's Parvez Ahmed speaks and writes about white privilege and shares his thoughts. Parvez Ahmed, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you, Melissa.
Well, the hashtag white privilege trended on Twitter when a woman accused of taking part in the Capitol Hill riots January 6th asked a federal judge for permission to go to Mexico on vacation. A work-related bonding retreat is what lawyers for Jenny Cudd of Texas said she needed to do. And initially, it seemed she was going to get this request. This was greeted with outrage on social media. As someone who has written and talked extensively about how our culture and our criminal justice system treats white defendants as opposed to non-white ones, what was your reaction?
Well, it's a continuation of the double standards that we have observed in the American criminal justice system between white defendants and people of color. Recalling my own experiences after the attack on our homeland on September 11th, Muslim Americans were targeted for surveillance. They were repeatedly asked to condemn terrorism. When the only connection between the terrorists who attacked us on September 11th and people like me was our common religion. There were frenzied protests, if you recall, when a Muslim group wanted to build a spiritual community center not far from the World Trade Towers. You may also recall my own saga going through the process of being confirmed as a human rights commissioner for the city of Jacksonville, when city council members were more interested in my views on quote-unquote Islamic terrorism than on my views on human rights.
Right. I remember you were even asked, one council person who's no longer on the council asked you to pray to your God.
He asked me to pray to my God before voting against me, as if to further accentuate that I am different from the rest of the members of city council who were going to confirm my nomination. So we have seen this movie play over and over again in our nation's history. If you think about it, the connection between an ordinary Muslim going about their life after 9/11 versus Republican elected officials, particularly congressional Republican elected officials, their connection to the incitement and the insurrection on January 6th, which one has more proximity? And yet, one group of people are, even up to today, and if you recall, sometimes we forget even history in our immediate past. Donald J. Trump ran on a platform of banning all Muslims from entering the country. He won despite such a bigoted platform. One of his first executive actions was to enact the Muslim travel ban, banning travelers from certain Muslim-majority countries. That ban was effectively upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, even though in a watered-down version. So essentially, what we have seen is, in my view, it essentially criminalized my religion. This from a political party, this from a country, this from a system that extols its virtue of being founded on the basis of religious freedom. And yet, that's what happened. But now we see a completely different standard being applied to the people who plotted, who executed, and who were complicit in the insurrection that happened on January 6th.
Most of the rioters at the Capitol were white. And right from the get-go, observers noticed just the kid glove treatment they received from police as the siege was unfolding. And now that they're proceeding through the criminal justice system, it seems there's a fresh wave of outrage almost every day. The rider who became internet famous for his bullhorns, for example, and his sort of fur pelt, the QAnon shaman, as he's known, Jake Angeli, he actually asked for organic food in prison. And so
yes.
These are the kinds of things that we've been watching unfold in the wake of the January 6th insurrection attempt. So
yeah, I'm all for people being accommodated for their religious belief or their worldviews, whether they're in prison or they're not. I mean, that's what makes us different as a country, that we make reasonable accommodations for people's religious views, even if they are in the criminal justice system. But what the contrast? I'm not begrudging that he was given his organic food, but the contrast is that while this is happening, we are getting reports that detainees in the immigration system, Muslim detainees in the immigration system, were fed pork. They asked for a halal meal, which is a Muslim-compliant meal, and they were not given that, but they were fed pork. So that kind of jarring contrast, ultimately this is not about what happens to the Muslim community, what happens in the contrast between how the protesters who were protesting against the brutal treatment of police against black communities, how Black Lives Matter protesters were treated versus insurrectionists on January 6th. It is not about a complaint. This is about a system. Because ultimately, it is not about what happens to this group or that group. Ultimately, what is at play is essentially the soul of our country, the soul of our system of justice, that it can indeed treat people equally, and it can distinguish between people who are part of a criminal network, part of a criminal conspiracy, versus people who just happen to have some association, either some association of faith or association of race or any other thing with a group of criminals. And what it suggests to me is that, you know, the question that we have to ask is, why are white perpetrators of terrorism and violence treated differently than black and brown perpetrators? And in my view, this is not an accident of history. In my view, this is the outcome of our caste-based system, so graphically and eloquently outlined in Isabel Wilkerson's bestseller, Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents. I urge all your listeners to read that book if they've already not read it. The long arc of American history is not just the case, is not just that we tell rosy stories to ourselves about the triumphs of justice, but also the stories that we hate to admit. The perpetuation of our caste-based society, where, in the words of Wilkerson, a fixed and embedded ranking of human value is based on the presumed supremacy of one group against the presumed inferiority of other groups on the basis of ancestry or other immutable traits. It is that presumed superiority that explains the hypocrisy in the way we treat terrorism committed by one group versus another.
I have read that book, and I do recommend it as well. It's profound and eye-opening. So thanks for referencing that, and thanks for your thoughts. Always good to get your insights, Parvez Ahmed. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Melissa. Bye-bye.
Well, are you a business owner? Listen up. There is a new group of angel investors in Jacksonville, and they're working to make available two of the most necessary assets any early stage company needs: capital and also advice and mentoring. Kay Nichols is a founding investor in Jack's Angels, and she told me more about the program. Kay Nichols, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Melissa.
So tell us more about Jack's Angels. It's billed as a first-of-its-kind angel investment group for this region and for locally headquartered companies. How is this investment group going to work?
Well, as you say, Jack's Angels is an angel investor group located right here in Jacksonville, Florida. We're focused on providing capital and expertise to early stage ventures in the greater Jacksonville area and the southeastern United States. And our mission is really to provide startups with access to the two most critical things they need to get going: capital and expertise. Those things are absolutely essential for startups in our region, Melissa.
Do you feel that businesses in Jacksonville don't have the same access to those two vital resources that maybe business leaders in other cities might enjoy?
Well, I think we have a number of actual angel investors here locally, but right now you're seeing unprecedented levels of new business startups. And so, frankly, we think we bring a critical resource to the table at this point in time. You just can't have too much investment available and resources to help these new companies get started in our community out there. So we're excited to engage. And we're seeing a lot of interest in our in the Jack's Angels opportunity. So clearly there's demand.
Sure. Now, you're looking to invest in early stage companies and startups that are currently in the market generating revenues, but want to go to the next level. We know that access to venture capital investment is harder for women, people of color, and other underserved groups. Will that be a special focus?
Well, we're sort of an equal opportunity organization. Yeah, we're most interested in targeting businesses where the startups are already in market generating revenue, as you say, with a short-term path to growth. Certainly, we're having a lot of interest from businesses run by women and minority groups, which is good to see. And a lot of our investors are women, which is also great. But importantly, we're looking at businesses run by highly qualified, dedicated teams that have complementary skills. And we're looking at specific industries where we know there's a lot of opportunity for growth. So areas like financial technology and medical technology, where there's a huge opportunity in Northeast Florida for these companies to really get some traction.
And, you know, as they say, timing is everything. You are launching this as we're on the tail end, hopefully, of the coronavirus pandemic. So how do you see the year and the decade unfolding as we come out of this difficult time? Are you hoping for a resurgence in the economy and in locally owned businesses having the wind at their backs coming out of this challenging era?
Yeah, well, in actual fact, during this period, we've been quite surprised. Since we started in 2019, June, and we've been operating through 2020, through the whole COVID environment, we've talked to over 150 entrepreneurs in this last 12, 18 months. You know, so there's a lot of pent-up demand there. And obviously, there's also people looking for opportunities now to start new businesses where they might not have had the time and opportunity to do so before. So we think there's a tremendous here sort of win-win situation for us coming to market at this point, because we do think there's a lot of pent-up demand. We're seeing an uptick in companies interested in talking to us about securing funding and support. We're also seeing an increasing number of investors who are interested in getting involved in supporting this kind of organization where, you know, there's potentially huge upside. There's a lot of risk, but there's potentially huge upside. But they're also doing good in helping companies to get going in our local community and thrive here. So, you know, really it's a real win-win situation. And I think it will do a lot of, it is a, as you say, a perfect storm for these things coming together as we come out of COVID.
With all of that said, how can interested businesses apply for funding and your network of resources?
Well, for more information, you can go to jacksangels.com. So, you know, if you are a entrepreneur looking for investment, go to jacksangels.com. We've got a lot more detail about our organization on the website, and you can sign up right there to be put into our process and to start to interact with us and go through our pipeline. Likewise, if you're an investor interested in getting involved in this kind of opportunity, you can sign up on, again, jacksangels.com, our website. You, again, find out more information, and we have a specific section for potential investors to sign up and get involved.
JacksAngels.com, and she's founding investor Kay Nichols. Kay, thanks so much.
Well, it's a real pleasure, and I'd encourage everyone to get involved. This is a great opportunity for our community.
Check it out, everyone. Go get that venture capital money. All right, a quick break, and in a moment, an activity you may not have heard of. It cleans the river, and it even helps police sometimes. Magnet fishing. We'll talk to one local dad doing it with his daughter. That's after this. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. Stay with us.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com. FPL, investing in Florida's tomorrow by committing to provide energy that's not just reliable and clean, but also more economical, all to deliver an energy future Florida can count on. Details online at fpl.com/value.
On the next Fresh Air, Terry talks with Dr. Anthony Fauci, America's top infectious disease expert. He's now President Biden's chief medical advisor. They'll talk about new strains of the coronavirus, working with the Trump administration when the president didn't follow some of the scientific advice he was given, and more. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Callum Borchers. People with Down syndrome are considered high risk for COVID-19, and many say they should be able to get an early vaccine shot. We'll talk with a woman with Down syndrome who's already had COVID-19 about her experience. That, and we review this year's virtual Sundance Film Festival. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
So, honeymoon over?
Things are not going to get done.
Progressives are turning up the pressure on the president.
There's a lot of people who hate your guts when you say stuff like, hold Joe Biden accountable. They're like, wait, whoa.
Biden has made some early overtures to those on the far left, but can he strike the right chord? The tempo and tenor of progressive politics. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, he's a local dad who was searching for a fun and safe activity to do with his daughter in the middle of this pandemic. And he got her outside, right? But what Jason Garcia came up with is not only helping the environment, but also local police. He told me more about magnet fishing. Take a listen.
Hey, Jason. Thanks so much for speaking with us. Good to have you on the show.
Nice to be here.
When you reached out to me to talk about this hobby you and your daughter have of magnet fishing, I hadn't heard of that. But magnet fishing, it cleans up rivers, springs, other bodies of water. Tell us about how you and your daughter Lauren got into this.
We watch a lot of YouTube, and we started out as snorkeling for river treasures, which is basically anything that anybody's lost in the river. And if we find something, we would return it to them. And as the season got colder, the people that we watched started doing magnet fishing. So that's where we heard about it.
And what is magnet fishing?
So basically what it is where you take a strong, powerful magnet that's tied to a rope. You throw it into any body of water, a river, a creek, a stream. And anything that's magnetic or ferrous will stick to it. And you just pull the rope and you pull it out and you can find all sorts of things.
And you and your daughter have, in fact, found all sorts of things. Tell us what has turned up.
We have. We've found, everything from the common rusty nail to just recently we found our third gun.
You've been finding loaded guns in the river, is that right?
The last gun we found was loaded, had a serial number on it. We called the sheriff's office, and they came and confiscated it from us.
And yeah, they might be using that in an investigation. So not only are you you're cleaning the river up, you're helping the police. It sounds like.
Well, you know, our hopes is that we will help solve a crime of some sort.
So in the pandemic, magnet fishing has taken off. This is really fascinating. It's a hobby that you've been doing with your daughter, but it's something that you can do in a socially distanced way, do outside. You've even set up a YouTube channel. It's called Daddy and Daughter Plus Water. Tell us about that.
Yeah, my daughter, who's 10 and in the fourth grade, wanted to start a page where we could share our adventures with everybody, not only so they can see what we can find, but to kind of educate people on some stuff that's in the water, educate them on a good way to spend time together as family or friends, and just something we could do to educate people on what magnet fishing is and, how easy it is and how fun it is.
And to that end, you have a giveaway that you're going to set up to get people excited about this. You're going to give away a magnet kit, is that right?
Yeah, we're hopefully in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be giving away a magnet kit, which includes a 950-pound pulling force magnet along with a rope and some gloves.
How can people enter to win this in this giveaway?
Probably the easiest way to do it is to subscribe to our YouTube page because that's primarily where we're going to be giving all the information out. If you subscribe and hit the notification, what it'll do is it'll let you know when we post videos, and that's how we're going to announce the giveaway.
I'll mention this again in a minute, but subscribe to the YouTube channel Daddy Daughter Plus Water to win this. Now, Jason, you've even reunited lost items with their owners, too, as you've been out pulling stuff out of the water, too. Is that right?
Yeah, we haven't been fortunate enough to find a phone or anything exciting like that, but we did find a set of keys. On the set of keys was a, I believe it was a CVS tag. We stopped at a CVS store. We asked if they would look up some information. They gave us contact number, and we reunited the keys to the person who lost them. They wouldn't say what the keys were to, but they did say it was of significant sentimental value.
Well, that's great. So again, go to Jason's YouTube channel, Daddy Daughter Plus Water. Learn all about magnet fishing that he's been doing with his 10-year-old daughter, Lauren. Register to win the magnet kit that he's going to give away. This is fascinating, and I want to thank you, Jason. Jason Garcia of World Golf Village, St. Augustine. Thanks for educating our listeners about this.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. And we also do have Instagram and a Facebook page. If anybody wants to learn more about magnet fishing, they can always reach out to me through that.
Check it out, Daddy Daughter Plus Water, on all of Jason's social media channels. And get out and clean the river. Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, including producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, news director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Keep those emails coming. We always value your feedback. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, our podcast will be up later today, wherever you like to listen, or through our WJCT app. Don't download that, too. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9, and we'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Stay warm, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.